Okay, let's unpack this. We live in a world that is just, obsessed with box office numbers. We track Marvel, we watch Avatar climb the charts, we obsess over opening weekends for Star Wars. But for a very, very long time, the absolute king of the hill wasn't a movie at all.
No, it wasn't a video game franchise either. It was a stage musical.
It's true. Until The Lion King finally managed to edge past it in what, 2014?
That's right. Before that, the Phantom of the Opera was the single most financially successful entertainment event in history.
That is just wild to me.
It's staggering. I mean, we are talking about global grosses over $6 billion. To put that in perspective, at the time it set that record, that was more than the original Star Wars, Titanic, and Avatar combined.
Combined. That is a lot of money for a story about a guy in a cape living in a sewer.
It really is. And today, we're not just here to hum music of the night.
Right.
We're on a mission to figure out how this happened. How did a secondhand paperback book become the longest running show in Broadway history?
And we're going to dig into the ruthless business decisions, right?
Sure.
The controversies in the sheet music and the show's surprisingly active afterlife that's happening right now in early 2026.
Exactly. Because you might know the mask or the chandelier crash.
Oh, yeah.
But the story behind the curtain is, I think, even more dramatic. A mix of artistic genius, accidental discoveries, and some pretty aggressive legal battles.
I'm so ready for this. Okay, so let's start at the very beginning. The spark. It's 1984. Andrew Lloyd Webber is basically the king of musical theater.
He is. He's coming off Cats, Evita. He can do
Damn.
no wrong. But he has this itch.
What's the itch?
He wants to write a romance, a big, sweeping, high-stakes, romantic story. He felt like that was the one thing he hadn't really cracked yet.
So where does he look for that?
Well, initially, he and Cameron Mackintosh, the legendary producer, they thought about adapting the old Phantom movies.
You mean the black and white ones? Like the Lon Chaney version from the 20s?
Exactly that one. The 1925 silent film and the 1943 Claude Rains version. They sat down and watched them, thinking, okay, how do we put this on stage? And
Right.
they hit a massive wall.
Why? I mean, it's a classic story.
Because those movies are monster flicks. They are horror movies. The focus is on the scare, the disfigurement, the shock of the unmasking.
Right.
And Lloyd Webber realized you just can't sustain a 2.5 hour musical on just fear. It becomes a novelty. They couldn't find the heart in it.
So it was almost a dead end.
Very, very close to being scrapped. Until Lloyd Webber was browsing a secondhand bookstore. He finds a copy of the original novel by Gaston Leroux. Now, this book had been out of print for a while. It wasn't a bestseller or anything. He read it, and that was the aha
So
moment.
what was so different about the book?
The book framed the story completely differently. It wasn't just about a monster terrorizing a theater. It was about a tragic, unrequited love. LaRue wrote The Phantom, Eric, not just as a killer, but as a genius, an architect, a composer, a magician who was so desperate for connection that he sort of became a monster.
And that's the key shift right there, moving from monster in the basement to tragic genius who just wants to be loved.
Precisely.
Yeah.
That decision is why the show ran for decades. If it's just a horror show, you go once. If it's a tragic romance, you go back 10 times to cry. It hooks your empathy.
But they needed a team. And this is one of my favorite little nuggets from the research. His first choice for a lyricist wasn't a Broadway guy.
No. He wanted Jim Steinman.
Jim Steinman, the guy who wrote Batter to Hell for Meatloaf.
The very same. And if you think about it, it makes perfect
It
sense.
does.
Steinman's style was gothic, obsessive, operatic rock. It fits the Phantom's vibe perfectly. Lloyd Webber approached him, but Steinman turned it down.
Why would you? Why did he do that?
He was busy producing a Bonnie Tyler album.
No way. So we missed out on a Jim Steinman fandom because of Total Eclipse of the Heart?
Effectively, yeah.
I mean, I love that song, don't get me wrong, but that has to sting a little in retrospect.
I'm sure. But it opened the door for a young, relatively unknown lyricist named Charles Hart. He stepped in with Richard Stilgoe and crafted lyrics that were much more classical, much more vulnerable.
A different show entirely.
A completely different show. So you've got the romance, you've got the team. Now you need the spectacle.
And Phantom is the definition of spectacle.
Yeah.
You can't talk about this show without talking about the chandelier.
It's the opening statement. The show starts in a prologue. It's 1919, a dreary auction at the old opera house, and they auction off Lot 666, a broken chandelier.
And then that famous organ overture kicks in. Dun, 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 dun.
Yes. and the chandelier rises over the audience. It flickers to life. The dust covers fly off the opera boxes, and we are visually transported back to 1881. It's a time machine.
It tells you right away, you are leaving the real world now.
Exactly.
And then there's the mask. I mean, it's beyond iconic.
Yeah.
But you said this wasn't the original plan.
No, it wasn't. In the very first preview at Lloyd Webber's private estate in Sydmonton, the actor wore a mask that covered his entire face.
Which, logically, makes sense if you're trying to hide something.
Logically, yes. Theatrically. A disaster. It muffled his voice. He couldn't project. He couldn't make eye contact. He had no peripheral vision.
So it's hard to act a tragic romance when your face is essentially a bucket.
Right. So the half mask was a hack. It was a practical solution. The designer, Marie Bjornsson, just cut the mask in half so the actor could sing and emote. And in doing so, she created the most recognizable logo in Broadway history.
That's amazing. We can't hear him cut the mask. Boom. History.
Yeah. And speaking of visuals, we have to mention the black box concept.
The what?
People remember Phantom as this lush, gold-gilded production, but the director, Hal Prince, actually used a very minimalist technique.
Minimalist? Phantom?
Relativistically, yeah. He envisioned a black box stage. He used heavy black velour curtains to frame everything so the illusions would just pop.
Give me an example.
The boat ride through the underground lake. If you built a realistic sewer set, it would look like styrofoam. But Hal Prince just used total darkness and had candelabras rising out of the mist.
So your brain fills in the rest of the picture.
Exactly. It's theatrical impressionism. The darkness makes the candles look magical. That was Hal Prince's genius.
Let's shift to the music, because the score is, well, it's a weird mix, isn't it?
It is eclectic, but it's intentional. Lloyd Webber uses musical styles to code the characters.
No.
The opera parts, the show within a show with Carlotta, are pastiches. They sound like Mozart or Meyerbeer. They're stiff, ornamental, the old world.
And then the Phantom comes in with his synthesizer.
Right. When the Phantom's music plays, like his own composition, Don Juan Triumphant, it's dissonant. It uses whole tone scales. It sounds modern. The music is telling us he's artistically ahead of his time.
A genius trapped in a world that only wants pretty tunes.
Exactly.
But speaking of the music, we have to address the elephants in the room. The plagiarism stuff.
Borrowed is the polite term, yes. This is pretty common in theater, but Phantom had some big ones. The estate of Puccini actually sued.
Over what?
They claimed a passage in Music of the Night was lifted from an aria in the opera La Fanciulla del Vest.
And they settled that one out of court, right?
Yeah.
Which usually means, here's some money, please go away.
Usually, yes. But the one that really gets rock fans fired up is the Pink Floyd connection.
Oh, I love this story.
So if you listen to the title track, The Phantom of the Opera, there is a chromatic five-note descending riff.
Dun, 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 dun.
That one, it is incredibly similar, I mean almost identical, to a riff in the Pink Floyd song Echoes from 1971.
And Roger Waters, the bassist for Pink Floyd, he knew about that.
He was furious. He knew it, but he never sued.
Why not?
His quote on it is legendary. He said, and I'm quoting here, "Life's too long to bother with suing Andrew fucking Lloyd Webber."
That is the ultimate rock star power move. I know you stole it, but I can't be bothered.
It just adds to the mystique, doesn't it?
It really does. So let's quickly trace that story the music serves. Paris Opera House, 1881. You have your love triangle, Christine, Raoul, and the Phantom.
And the pacing is relentless. You get the backdrop falling during rehearsals, which establishes the threat. Then Christine's triumph in Think of Me. And then, almost immediately, the abduction.
Through the mirror. I am your angel of music. Come to me. So creepy, but so compelling.
And that leads to the first big turning point, the unmasking.
Right. She rips the mask off out of pure curiosity.
And that's when the dynamic changes. He goes from mysterious teacher to raging, ashamed monster, but a vulnerable one. She sees his shame.
But the real climax comes later.
Act two. He murders the lead tenor, takes his place on stage, and performs The Point of No Return with Christine. It's a musical seduction in front of a full audience.
Then he kidnaps her again.
Which leads to the final ultimatum. He's trapped Raoul in a noose, the Punjab lasso. He tells Christine, stay with me, he lives, leave with him, he dies.
An impossible choice. Horrific blackmail. But she flips the script.
She does. She doesn't fight him. She walks right up to the Phantom and kisses him.
She shows him compassion, probably for the first time in his life.
And that just breaks him. It destroys him. He realizes he can't force love. He lets them both go. He's left alone, huddled under his cloak, and vanishes.
A tragic but satisfying ending. And clearly it worked. The show ran forever. Which brings us to the business of that longevity, because forever gets complicated.
It does. I mean, the records are clear. London in 86, Broadway in 88, longest running show in Broadway history.
And it broke barriers. We have to mention Norm Lewis, the first African-American Phantom on Broadway.
A huge moment. But longevity brings its own problems, and this is where we get into the controversy around COVID.
Right. So March 2020, the world shuts down, theaters go dark. But in London, something sketchy happened.
Sketchy is the word a lot of fans would use, yes. Cameron Mackintosh announced that the original London production was closing permanently. He said they needed to refurbish the theater.
Which was true. The building needed work. But then they reopened it.
They did, in July 2021. But here's the catch. It wasn't the original production. It was a new version. And the changes caused an uproar.
What did they change?
The orchestra was cut pretty significantly, from 27 musicians down to 14.
Wow, that's almost half.
It is. They removed the famous angel statue from the proscenium arch. They modified the bridge.
So they basically took the cheaper touring version and just parked it in the flagship theater.
That was the accusation. It's a classic tension between artistic preservation and economic reality. Mackintosh argued it was simply too expensive to keep running the old version.
He said, I have to cut costs to save the show.
Right. But the fans and the musicians' union saw it as a cash grab. They argued you're charging full West End prices for a reduced product.
It's the Ship of Theseus paradox for musicals. If you change all the parts, is it still the same show?
Exactly. And while London got this elite version, Broadway kept the original until it didn't.
Yeah, the end of an era, the Broadway closing. April 16, 2023.
A massive cultural moment. 13,981 performances. The irony is, it was losing money every week after the pandemic. Mm. But as soon as they announced the closing date,
ticket sales went through the roof.
Skyrocketed. FOMO is a powerful drug. Everyone wanted to see it one last time. But ultimately, the economics won. It closed.
You'd think, okay, that's it. Good run. Put the mask in a museum.
Yeah.
But here we are in 2026, and the Phantom is busier than ever.
The show refuses to die. It just shapeshifts.
Okay, let's talk about what's happening right now. Mid-2025, Masquerade opens off Broadway. I'm hearing so much about this.
This is a fascinating pivot. It's an immersive musical production.
So you're inside the show.
Exactly. You walk through a multi-story experience. You are a patron of the Opera Populaire. You're in the dressing rooms, the manager's office. It's a way to package nostalgia for an audience that wants an experience.
It sounds incredible.
And they brought back Hugh Pinaro, who played the Phantom for years. So it has real legitimacy.
And if that's not your thing, how about anime?
Yes. This news dropped in August 2025. LW Entertainment Lloyd Webber's company is adapting the musical into an anime.
When I first heard this, I thought it was a joke. But the more I think about it,
yeah,
it kind of fits, doesn't it?
It fits perfectly. Anime handles high melodrama, gothic aesthetics, and supernatural stuff better than almost any other medium. You can do things with animation that look cheesy in live action.
You can really lean into the horror and the fantasy.
Exactly. And on top of that, Lloyd Webber hinted in June 2025 about a new live action film remake.
Right. He's looking for a Phantom in his early 40s. Which feels like a direct response to the 2004 movie.
It does. The 2004 film with Gerard Butler was, let's say, divisive.
Divisive is very diplomatic of you.
So a new film could be an attempt to get it right this time, to create a definitive screen version.
And we shouldn't forget Love Never Dies.
Ah, the sequel. The one set in Coney Island where the Phantom runs a freak show.
It had mixed reviews, to say the least.
Mm.
But it persists. Mm. People are still obsessed with these characters. So we've gone from a used book in 1984 to a chandelier crash, to an immersive experience and an anime in 2026.
It's a testament to the adaptability of the story. You can strip away the orchestra, change the medium, but the core archetype remains.
And what is that core?
It's the outsider. We all feel like the outsider sometimes.
That's the thing, isn't it? The Phantom is a murderer, a kidnapper. By all logic, he's the villain.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the audience roots for him. They weep for him.
Mm-hmm.
Which raises the big question I want to leave everyone with today. Does this show romanticize a toxic, dangerous obsession? Or is it actually a story about the transformative power of compassion, about seeing the person behind the mask?
It's a fine line, and I think every audience member draws that line in a different place. That ambiguity is why we're still talking about it 40 years later.
That's what makes it art. Well, whether you're Team Raoul or Team Phantom, thanks for diving deep with us today.
It was a pleasure.
See you in the next deep dive.